Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week...
Want to know what day papers sell the most copies?
Gasp! Retail store doesn't play by the PR rules.
ABC Radio National starts covering media again.
Rebranding Mardi Gras.
And the week in TV.
The act who will take the final place in the X Factor Grand Final is...
With us today at the studios of CBS Interactive is podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Hello.
And Mumbrella publisher Martin Lane.
Morning.
So Melbourne High Street fashion store Gasp found itself in the middle of a social media storm when its outrageous response to a disgruntled customer went viral in September. Let's take a listen to store representative Matt Chidgey's appearance on Seven at the time.
Matt, I've got to ask you, when things like this happen in our world these days, the first thing that a lot of people think is this is a publicity stunt. Was it?
Not on our part. I'm not sure about Kira, but I mean, our shops are packed. Everyone knows us now, and I can't thank her enough for what she did for us.
Really?
Yes.
Now, Robin, a bit of an ancient story this, but it moved on this week after you had another chat to them. What happened?
Yeah, indeed it did. Well, it's brought to our attention by a website which believe that Gasp being guilty of astroturfing. Which landed it in more hot water. There's astroturfing comments on websites such as The Punch and Moxie.
Astroturfing being when you put in a positive comment as if it's from a neutral person,
yeah.
When really you're just the brand, you know.
In effect, defending the brand's actions.
Fake grassroots.
Yeah, indeed. And I spoke to, after that, I managed to get through to Gasp's retail business manager, Dave McCann. He told me that he had no idea about the astroturfing comments. And indeed, if there had been astroturfing, he'd been disappointed if there had been, because it went against Gasp's approach to social media. Basically, he said that what happened in September was of greatly beneficial to the company. He said that even though that you know all the comments online were negative, he saw that the greatest uplift in turnover all year.
So the any publicity is good publicity theory.
Yeah, no, indeed, and he at the time when there's the furore, he spoke to he sought advice from a PR agency. They actually told him to distance himself from the employee, to apologise and also address the comments made. But he told me that he went against all of that advice, and the results were outstanding.
I wonder if the agency still sent him a bill.
Yeah, no, indeed. Yeah, no, he said that, and I quote, "Our unorthodox approach is what has made us successful. We have done the opposite of what we've been told to do by PR firms, and the results have been outstanding."
Mark, you're a journalist.
I just love the fact that PR companies always seem to advise you to in these circumstances, what you should do is blame a junior member of staff. And we've seen that on Mumbrella a few times. It may or may not have been a junior member of staff who was responsible, but I just like the fact that for once they didn't cop it.
Next, the media report returns to ABC Radio National.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Microcitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at cradiodifferently.com.
The ABC's Radio National has reinstated the radio show The Media Report after 3 years. The show was previously hosted by Anthony Fennell before being dropped in January 2009. The new host will be Richard Eadie, who currently presents Life Matters. Other movements, Auntie, will see The Chaser's Julian Morrow move to the new Friday drive time slot, as Waleed Ali hosts the Monday to Thursday slot, and Robbie Buck will host the new Daily Show Afternoon Music from 3 p.m. And I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this. Why is it that so few broadcasters in Australia, Marty, are interested in regularly covering media?
Maybe they don't think it's very interesting. It's a bit of navel gazing, really, isn't it? I don't think Australia does these type of shows particularly well anyway. And, you know, maybe it's a crowded marketplace. There's, you know, Media Report, Media Watch. Maybe they think there's enough.
But you don't think Media Watch is... I think Media Watch is brilliant.
Yeah, I know. Media Watch is fine. I mean, it's okay. It's what the papers say with, you know, rebranded for an Australian audience, really, isn't it? Which is fine as far as it goes. But, I mean, I don't know. Maybe they just don't think there's enough to talk about.
Well, coming from, obviously, just relocating from Singapore, I found the coverage of media in Australia is far more extensive than it is there, and certainly more extensive than it is in the UK. I don't know if you disagree with that. But, yeah, no, I think that generally Australians have more of an appetite for media than in most countries. But, yeah, no, on the Media Report, I wondered, I mean, a lot of media is so visual. I wondered whether it actually works on radio, as opposed to TV, where it seems to work better on Gruen.
I mean, I would argue it should work well. I mean, for instance, I still regularly listen to Media Guardian, does a very good podcast out of the UK, and also the BBC in the last year or two started doing the media show, which again is very high quality. You've got On the Media from the US is a very good podcast that also goes out on public radio in the US. My problem was I used to be in the habit of listening to, sort of going for a run of a Saturday morning, listening to a few podcasts, and I'd listen to the Media Guardian one, and it'd be quite punchy, quite pacey, quite interesting, you know, maybe have a listen to On the Media. And then I would listen to the old guys of the Media Report, and it was like running into a wall. You'd smack into a wall, you'd fall back, and then if you carried on listening, you'd be running through really heavy treacle. It was so boring. Just one of the most interesting industries around, just told in such a plodding way. So, you know, I'm not sure how much it's down to the presenter and how much whoever was producing it at the time. But at the time, it was slow and worthy and lacking in insight. So here's hoping it's better next time.
Is that also partly maybe a Radio National thing? You know, they toned it down for an older audience as opposed to ABC
not.
One who
no,
widens
I'd
their...
I'd argue not, because Radio National has a lot in common with BBC Radio 4.
Okay.
They do a very good media show. You listen to something like Breakfast with Frank Kelly, pacey, interesting, you know, Radio National flagship. So there's nothing, you know, there's nothing in that says they can't do it. It's just... having, I guess, some... It just felt like a show where the energy had gone out of it.
Do you think that with the success of, say, the Gruen Transfer or Planet, whichever one, also Hamster Wheel, do you think that there's been a bit of confidence restored in ABC as far as being able to sex up the media?
Well, it'd be interesting to see how much they cover commercial media, because that was one issue, was they rarely covered commercial media. You know, it was very much just about the worthy end of journalism, you know, so it would be, you know, and now we're going to have a 20-minute report on, you know, how the media is covering hunger in developing nations or something. Very worthy, but, you know, so earnest and so boring.
Could it be partly because the print media is a bit more tame here as well? I mean, you haven't got that real kind of tabloid culture that you've got.
I don't know. I disagree about the tameness. I mean, just look at the wars you get going on between, say, Crikey and The Australian, for instance, or generally between News Limited and Fairfax. There's a good scrap every week. You know, I mean, just look at the moment. I mean, it's a real shame there is no media show on air at the moment because, you know, Media Watch has already taken its summer holiday. So you've got the media inquiry going on, and the ABC just, other than the news coverage, you've got nowhere to talk about it.
Tim, you're on TV and radio a fair amount. Which media show would you most like to feature on and why?
Well, the thing is, the slogan of Media Watch is everyone loves it until they're on it, because I think it should be every journalist's ambition to never feature on Media Watch because something has gone badly wrong at the point at which you do. So once you rule that one out, then you've kind of run out of options, really, haven't you? Next, Mardi Gras gets a rebrand.
The Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras is rebranding. With guidance from Moon Communications, the idea is reinventing Mardi Gras to make it more relevant to all people. The organisation and march was created in 1978. It's been about fighting AIDS and anti-discrimination until now. Now, of course, it's about celebrating the power of diversity. In a weird twist, this week we hear that marketing director of Mardi Gras is so proud of the new logo, he's getting it tattooed on his arm. Tim, so what do you
think?
Sounds
like a stunt to me.
Yeah, no, indeed.
I wonder if it's a permanent tattoo.
I did ask that question, and I'm told that it is absolutely permanent. But what do you think about Mardi Gras? Is it due for a brand makeover?
No, I thought it was fine as it was, to be quite honest. I mean, good on them to keep evolving it, but I don't think there was a big problem. You know, you look at it, big crowds and diverse crowds already. So, you know, they're... You know, maybe they're reflecting what's already a reality, which is it's already beyond sort of, you know, strictly kind of gay audience. So maybe it's moving to reflect what kind of cosmopolitan Sydney has already woken up to, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the new strapline I hear is something along the lines of inspiring the world to love each other. So it's all about being inclusive and, loving each other. Colin, what do you think about the new Mardi Gras repositioning?
Well, I kind of like the fact that they've repositioned it before it needed it, almost in a sense that they're telling, you know, the wider community there isn't as much of a problem anymore, which might have sort of a...
Problem as in discrimination.
And might have a kick-on effect for the bigger community to go, oh, it's not such a big problem anymore, and sway their opinion, you know, and sort of dilute... the issues behind or not dilute the issues but dilute the opinions.
Martin, what do you think? Will you be marching this year?
I'm sort of with Tim, to be honest. I mean, yeah, I've always thought it's been a fairly inclusive kind of event. You know, you don't hear it referred to as the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. It's referred to as Mardi Gras. And has been for a long time. I mean, you know, compared to kind of, you know, gay pride marches of previous years, I guess. And to me, it's kind of, you know, it's part of the Sydney kind of landscape. It's something that certainly people like Destination New South Wales promote very heavily as a major event in the city. So kind of, yeah, I mean, as Tim said, good on them for doing it, but I don't entirely think it's necessary.
Yeah, I mean, your expertise is in travel. Mardi Gras is seen as an attraction for Sydney, but also for Australia. Do you think it does a lot for brand Sydney and brand Australia to rebrand Mardi Gras?
I don't think it makes any difference. I think it's a big, major event in this city that brings people from all over the world and all sorts of people from all over the world. So, anything that boosts numbers, boosts attendance is a good thing for Sydney. But I think Mardi Gras is a good thing for Sydney already.
Next, The Week in TV.
This week, The X Factor has been getting into its final days for Seven as the grand finale approaches. Colin, you've been watching this season. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's. I've been suckered into the popness of it, I must admit. We're into the finals weeks with just three finalists. Andrew, the old pub rocker. Johnny, the R&B dreamboat, and Reese, the screechy one. Three wishes left this week, which was a disappointment, I thought. But I think what really needs to be pointed out is the way they lure you in with their long gaps when they boot someone off. Let's just take a listen to presenter Luke as to how long it takes for him to announce the results.
The act who will take the final place in the X Factor Grand Final is... Your third grand finalist for this year is... Reese!
So 21 seconds he dragged on for there.
Anyway, at least they didn't have a commercial break.
No, they just about could have, though. The smart money, I think, is on Reese. Johnny's too much of a pretty face and Andrew's a bit too old, so money's on Reese.
And ratings-wise, are the sponsors going to be happy?
Yeah, I think so. The two key sponsors have been Xbox and McDonald's. X Factor aren't as heavily branded as MasterChef with their sort of on-air branding. You get a few bits on screen. However, one week, for example, McDonald's, you know, they're currently running this back by popular demand theme. And so, you know, bringing back the McFeast and various other foodstuffs. As a result, X Factor did a back by popular demand sort of hits of number one gone by. And we also saw them, the contestants, at Sunday's McHappy Day on this past Tuesday's episode. So McDonald's are getting in there.
It's all about the product integration.
Yeah. Ratings-wise, X Factor, yeah, sponsors will be happy. X Factor seems to win almost every Monday and Tuesday night. On their opening week, the Tuesday's episode was highest. It got sort of 1.69 mil, and that was that opening week was stripped across the full week. This week's episode pulled 1.5 mil for the Tuesday app, and Monday's episode pulled 1.4 mil. So they're doing pretty well.
Well, it's also the last week for Celebrity Apprentice, which I think the final is Monday night next week, if I recall, Monday or Tuesday. With, as we record, Jason Coleman, Julia Morris, Shane Crawford and Jacinta Campbell left in. So that one is kind of reaching its final stages. Got to say, a bit of a hit, that one, maybe a surprise hit. So Nine's strategy of stripping it across weeknights seems to have worked. Marty, what have you been watching on TV recently?
I'm afraid I kind of exist in some sort of parallel television universe. In that I'm a big fan of UK TV. I mean the channel, not a generic term.
Years you've been in Australia, you might as well not have come to Australia at all.
Well, the weather's better, and the longer I'm here, the more I miss the BBC. I have to say, I don't want to sound like a whinging pom, but I do. But yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about this conversation actually while you were talking, and
I'm thinking maybe I should play some sort of involve myself in the local culture.
I found myself this week reading on the Sun's website about Freddie Starr appearing in the latest edition of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which is filmed in Australia, will be screened on UK TV, the channel, in Australia next year sometime. And it's almost, you know, it's kind of really odd. I live in the country. I read about something that's screened in the UK but filmed here. And I don't really know what any of that means other than the world's getting smaller.
Well, the world's getting smaller, and yet...
And so's my mind.
And you remain a little Englander. Robin, have you shown any interest in local culture?
I have. I've only yet to acquire a TV, so I'm sort of back in the game. But, yeah, I was intrigued by Celebrity Apprentice, but really in a more sort of voyeuristic way. Not necessarily involving myself...
From Jacinta. Because of Jacinta Campbell?
Possibly, yeah. it's just interested in the format. But, yeah, as a viewer, it's hard to sort of disengage myself as someone who writes about media, someone who's actually a consumer of media. So, I'm in two minds as to whether I actually enjoy it or whether I'm sort of compelled to watch it because it's part of my job.
And in Celebrity Apprentice related news, it's worth noting that Maxim yesterday named publicist Max Markson Tool of the Year. So congratulations, Max, from all of us.
Husqvarna must be very disappointed none of their tools got a look in.
Next, Magazine Week and the Publishers Australia Excellence Awards.
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
Last week was Magazine Week. As Adam Spencer pointed out, as host of the Publishers Australia Excellence Awards on the Friday evening, the publishing industry is moving so fast Magazine Week only goes for 2 days. So Tim, you did a Mumbrella Question Time with Jeff Hurd, who's chairman of Publishers Australia, MPA chairman Nick Chan, who's also CEO of PacMags, Peter Russell, GM of marketing at Fisher & Paykel, and Simon Davies, head of print at media agency OMD.
So Martin, I was moderating that session. You were there in the audience, threw in a question. One of the topics that did come up was this question of magazines not being terribly good as a medium at branding themselves. That kind of seemed to be the majority view. You, I guess, have worked most of your journalistic career in magazines. Is it a fair view, do you think?
It was interesting. I think Simon Davies, who's head of print at OMD, described some magazines as being commodities, and Nick Chan got very upset at that point, and there was a good, robust debate about it.
Well, let's hear a clip.
We've done a shit job of actually branding our medium out there, haven't we? We have. I mean,
Simon thinks they're a commodity.
What do you think?
They're not. I mean, it's as simple as that. I spend half my waking hours worrying about how we can be, you know, certain brands can be better at what they do. And if that wasn't the case, we'd just do, you know, we would do exactly what every cost-cutting company has always wanted, which is, why don't you use the same team to do every magazine? That's not what we do. And the audience, the consumers don't do that. I mean, is Mark Fletcher in the audience? He'll tell you that people come in and actually ask for a magazine. If it was all the same, they wouldn't do that.
It kind of actually, really, to widen it out a bit, the whole kind of content reminded me a little bit of when I used to go to travel conferences a few years ago when the internet sort of first came along and travel agents used to kind of all talk about how they could add value and the things that they could offer that the internet couldn't, et cetera, et cetera. All of which was true, but it was like they were kind of wrapping themselves in some kind of collective comfort blanket. And it reminded me a little bit of that magazine week. A lot of people talking about how great magazines are, but perhaps not enough practical examples of how magazines can and need to evolve in order to meet the needs of readers and advertisers. So, certainly there is a PR job that needs to be done, but it's not enough just to say magazines are great, don't forget us, look at what we can do. It's more about evolving the product, I think.
I thought it was also interesting, this conversation around, and I think this is a debate that's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. You know, we've got some of the big players looking to evolve from being about magazines to being media brands. And then one of the topics that came up at that debate was this question of, don't be a media brand. Remember, what gives you the magic in the first place is that you're a magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, obviously there's brand extensions within that, but the core is the thing that gives the whole thing life is the magazine. The problem is, of course, that, you know, circulations are declining and that there's so many other channels now that you know, whether you call it a brand or whether you call it the magazine, it needs to put its content in other media. And as I say, I would have liked to have heard a few more case studies where people have done that. There was a very interesting discussion about, you know, apps and looking at, you know, you've got to get your content right and you can obsess with building, you know, the killer app. But if you haven't got the content in the first place, then that's just another channel to promote bad content, which I think is a good point. And we do tend to get a little bit caught up with the technology. But nevertheless, you know, there's no doubt that magazines, you know, if you've got somebody like Simon Davis questioning the value of magazines and he's head of print at OMD, then you know you've got a problem.
Are there any brands that you guys think do a particularly good job or bad job of branding themselves? I mean, one that strikes me has done an excellent job over the years is The Economist. I mean, it's got some of the most, dare it be said, iconic advertising over the past 10, 20 years. And that certainly does, in my mind, it's got a very, very clear, very, very strong brand. But beyond that, I'm not sure there are too many others that jump at me immediately.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the problems for magazines is The Economist is that great example everyone comes to, and it's actually hard to come to another one which has achieved its positioning through branding. You know, you get titles like, I guess, Time magazine, you know, the Man of the Year, or now as it is Person of the Year cover, and all of those things are, you know, are really significant moments, or you know, another US example, you know, Vanity Fair. But I think that's more about the content and the longevity, yes, rather than actual branding.
Yeah. For example, yeah, the Forbes does a power index. There's Time magazine that does, you know, the most, the top men of the year or women of the year. But again, as you say, that's content and not actually the masthead that's driving that branding. The week culminated in the Publishers Australia Excellence Awards on Friday night. In total, there were 27 awards. We won't run through all of them. So, Tim, which do you pick out as the big winners?
Okay, the big winners. Well, Marie Claire won Magazine of the Year over 50,000 circulation and also the Overall Excellence Award. So I guess Marie Claire certainly walks away with the biggest boasting rights. Vogue Living won for Consumer Magazine under 50,000. Worth noting that both of those are new competitors in the Publish Australia Awards, because previously the MPA, which is the Magazine Publishers of Australia, which is all a bit like the People's Popular Front of Judea and the Popular People's Front of Judea, isn't it? But the MPA has now joined the board of Publishers Australia, which means that the big players and the niche players are all fighting on the same field. A few of the other bigger ones. B2B Magazine of the Year went to Food Service. Custom Magazine of the Year went to Qantas, The Australian Way. And Website of the Year, I'm glad have to say, went to Mumbrella.
Martin, your thoughts on the night?
I thought it was a good evening. Everybody had a good time.
There were moments when you were frowning, though, weren't there?
Well, I think when we were named runner-up in about 100 categories, I started to get a little bit frustrated, but we won the big one in the end.
Martin is officially the second smallest publisher in Australia.
Yes, correct. And Tim is the joint second editor of the year, I think.
Yes, beaten by GQ's editor, yes. I think.
Enough navel gazing. I thought there was a good split of awards going to MPA members and PA members. I thought that was diplomatic, shall we say. But the one thing that did strike me, and Jeff Hurd alluded to it at the end, is that these awards are going to get more difficult to win. The competition's been ramped up. So I think next year, and that's good because the credibility will increase. We'll certainly be in it to win it next year, but I suspect it's going to get harder.
I can't remember if that was my fifth or my sixth Publishers Australia Awards. By far the best, I thought. First move to an evening, more people than ever before, felt far more glamorous and serious and grown up than before, I really felt it had moved on.
But in terms of publicising the results, I think they could have done better. The press release went out a little bit too late, didn't it? And we had to actually, I think you wrote the story, Tim, you had to enter the winners manually, and the press release followed 3 days after.
Which I don't think we can claim is the best piece of investigative journalism ever, the hardship of having to type in the results. But it was somewhat ironic when a press release dropped, many hours or even a day or two later.
Just to defend them, though, as a member of Publishers Australia, I feel duty bound to. I mean, it's a small organisation in terms of the kind of support that they've got. You go into the office and it's not much bigger than the room that we record this podcast in. I think, they're doing, and a lot of them obviously are doing it in their own time. So I think, they should get a lot of credit. Yeah, there were a few things that fell through the cracks, but Jeff Hurd said to me afterwards, if as far as Magazine Week is concerned, if this had been year three, I would have been, really, really pleased. And in year one, I'm delighted. And I think he should be.
Yeah, they had good turnout. And it really showed that the organisation itself has kind of evolved. There is a real chance now that if everything goes right, the whole industry comes behind the awards. And the whole industry maybe speaks as one voice as well, So as an organisation, it has evolved.
Next, what's the worst day for advertising in newspapers?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week saw the Audit Bureau of Circulation release data broken down into individual days of the week for the first time. Daily reporting becomes obligatory at the start of next year, but for this release, only News Limited has voluntarily participated. Now, while Saturdays are generally highest across the board, except I think for Sydney's Daily Telly, the results show variations across weekdays more so. So the worst day of the week for circulation does vary from paper to paper. If you're not fussed on what day to go in, because you're not targeting a particular section that only goes in one day a week, then avoid the Courier Mail on Mondays, the Advertiser and the Herald Sun on Tuesdays, the Australian on Thursdays, and the Telly Saturday edition, and you might find your ad dollars go fractionally further. The overall sales obviously came alongside this, and they weren't generally that great. Overall picture, still not that pretty for newspapers. The Sydney Morning Herald's Monday to Friday fell by more than 7%, followed by the Sunday Herald Sun falling by just over 6%, and then the Sunday Age posted the highest growth, which was only, it was only just above standstill, it was less than 1%. And I've not looked in detail on the certificates yet, but I'm led to believe that a lot of that did come through, within the rules, but making the most use of bulks as well. So there wasn't a very pretty picture. Marty, when was the last time that you bought a paper?
Well, forgive my ignorance, but do those numbers with the days of the week include frees?
Yes, they would, but in order to get your ABC certificate, only a certain proportion can be free, and they have to be broken out into different, what are charmingly known as buckets.
Right.
So you have your your educational bucket, which is sort of split between, I think, tertiary and secondary, if I remember rightly. Then, you know, the ones given out free as, you know, you arrive at, you know, Fitness First or whatever. But all of that, there's a cap on how many free there can be.
The reason for the question is that I seem to be certainly at the weekends being trained not to buy a newspaper. I mean, you know, I can't go out without somebody trying to thrust a copy of a newspaper in my hands. If I go and watch the rugby league, then I get a copy on the way out. If I go to the gym, I get a copy on the way in. So certainly I don't buy newspapers at the weekends because I don't need to. Someone's going to give me one.
For me, two questions sort of arise from this. First of all, I understand, Tim, that there's been a lot of demand for this sort of detailed data from advertisers.
The demand from advertisers actually was they wanted issue-specific data. So they wanted to be able to look back at last Wednesday and see how many copies were sold of their ad. All they've got is an average number across the 3 months. They know on Wednesdays across the last 3 months. So it doesn't go as far as advertisers would like and probably goes further than the newspapers would want to give.
Yeah. Do you think that this could lead to an increase in ad spend? I guess is my first question, or increase in ad spend on newspapers. Secondly, do media planners actually plan by the day? I mean, they're so busy and they've got so many different things to think about. Do they actually really, does it affect the day-to-day, you know, workings of their job, planning by the day? Does the job include that much detail?
I mean, I'd argue that affecting ad spend, no, it might to a very small extent shift the day that the spend is. So if you're committed to newspapers and you have a look and you see if you go in one day then another, and actually you're not that fussed which day of the week it is that your campaign's going in, then you might shift to the day that's got, you know, 10 or 15% more audience for the same price. But of course, generally, you know, campaigns are tied to a certain day. So, you know, say you're just hypothetically a travel brand that's trying to, you know, reach consumers when they're kind of in the headset that they're just back at work and feeling miserable, you know, and want to book a holiday, then you may say to yourself, okay, Mondays is the day. So that will be your strategy rather than, you know, which is the actual day. And then the other thing, of course, is some advertising is sectional. You know, you might want to be in, you know, the food supplement that's on a particular day of the week, or the going out supplement or whatever. So sometimes you're kind of locked into it anyhow.
Do you think it might hurt yields on the days which are less popular?
It's a negotiation point, isn't it? You know, everything is a negotiation point between the media agencies and the papers. And, of course, the media agencies will use it as a stick to beat the newspapers with to say, this is why you should give us a discount. And no doubt, in just the same way, the papers will be arguing, yeah, but look how many more we're giving you on another day. So, therefore, maybe you should be paying us 10% more on that day. So, yeah, it'll be another negotiation point.
Of course, this is a move to make newspapers more transparent. So I think it was last year, Tim, that you did an investigative report into newspapers actually upping their circulation in a bogus fashion by dumping bulk copies targeted at students that actually weren't read at all. It was a ruse to increase circulation. Do you think this report will move on the debate on how transparent newspapers are?
Do you know, it moves it on a little bit. So one of the issues, and, you know, even last year, you know, it was never a question that they're actually breaching the rules. It was a question whether the rules were too loose. My understanding now is that in order to qualify as an educational copy, you have to demonstrate that it's gone into somebody's hand. You know, it's not good enough that it's been delivered to the newsagent and then, you know, it's been dumped afterwards. You've got to prove that someone came in and collected it. That's my understanding of it. So it's a bit tighter. You know, the sort of calls you get from, you know, people who are rivals to people who've done well suggests that there are still loopholes that are worth a look, and we will be taking a look.
Why has this taken so long to come out as compared to TV ratings, which, you know, we get a daily one, we've been getting it for so long? Is it just harder to calculate, or
There's a cost involved, yeah. Obviously, in assessing everything. So, for instance, TV ratings, there's an awful lot of money spent every single day on TV. So that, you know, some of it is, as a proportion, what you'll spend on, you know, getting Austan to provide the data is a relatively small proportion of the ad spend. So that's some of it. Because, you know, that's always the argument when advertisers ask for more transparency is, well, that's fine, but are you willing to, you know, pay more to fund that transparency? So I think that's probably a part of it. Similarly with radio, you know, with the diary system, you know, no one's found a better system to know the next morning, you know, how Kyle and Jackie O actually rated. We still have to wait every 6 weeks or so to get a kind of guesstimate based on people's diaries.
Yeah, and Nielsen will now be taking over, obviously, the online measurement side of things. If there's a league table of which media is being most transparent at the moment, perhaps... Tim, what do you think? Who do you think's leading the race at the moment?
Do you know? I would say not online, funnily enough, right. Because there are still too many kind of rorts and dodges. You know, there's less auto refresh and that sort of thing now. Not radio, because as I say, it's a diary system, so probably brands which have higher awareness probably do better, because people think, oh yes, I must have listened to that. As I say, there are questions about, you know, the ABC circulation for newspapers and magazines doesn't reflect paid, doesn't, you know, it reflects how many are circulated. So that's, you know, that isn't necessarily a total measure. So in the end, you start coming back to TV. You know, it's not perfect, but you know, it's probably not a bad guesstimate. That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Martin.
Pleasure.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pip.
I can be Fiona if you want me to be Fiona. I can be whoever you want me to be.